Hey guys, Bill here. Big show today. Bill Connelly, ESPN, is on in a moment. First, we're going to have Todd McShay on. He'll be talking about new quarterbacks from this year's draft class. And if you want to listen to Todd talk about them at greater length, you can listen to the First Draft podcast. Because with Mel Kiper, the two most trusted voices when it comes to the NFL draft, talking about all things draft over the next several weeks in podcast form. Listen to that by subscribing to the First Draft podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Do that for the Bill Barnwell Show as well. And you can listen to the Bill Barnwell Show with Todd McShay and Bill Connelly right now. Joining me now here on the Bill Barnwell Show, as promised, is ESPN's Todd McShay. Todd, how are you?
I'm doing well. How's it going, Bill?
I'm good. We're all hanging in there. All excited about the draft. Some content for us to work with in a relatively devoid sports landscape at this point. But, Todd, of course, you've been covering the NFL draft for us for several years now. You do great work. Always love reading your stuff. But I think a lot of the time, you know, you're focused on giving evaluations on prospects. It's very sort of, you know, player-specific. So I just want to kind of take a step backwards and just ask about kind of the bigger picture stuff as someone who, you know, for people who are interested in the game and interested in sort of, you know, watching quarterbacks, understanding, you know, what someone who does this for a living is thinking. Let's just start with this. Let's start with the broadest question. In terms of evaluating a quarterback, what's the first thing or what's the first couple things you look for that really start helping you form an opinion?
It's brutal. I wish there was I can give you the answers that everyone in the league will give you. You know, mental makeup certainly is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And accuracy to me is the second biggest part. Okay. But how do you measure those things? That's the struggle. You know, some of the best quarterbacks that I've ever evaluated, that we've ever watched, are some of the biggest jerks, if you will, out sure. there. Some guys are kind of, you know, a little bit more laid back, but still handle their business and are just more, I don't want to say more cerebral, but are cerebral with their approach. That's the hardest part, is getting to know the player and then trying to figure out mentally who they are. The accuracy, it's a lot easier, obviously, to evaluate. Arm strength is the most overrated aspect of evaluating a quarterback, in my opinion, but it's the first thing that jumps off the tape. I mean, I've got a five-year-old son. Tate could go sit down right now with me and say, yeah, he has a strong arm. He doesn't have a strong arm, you know, mm-hmm. after watching five players. Accuracy is difficult because you have to, first of all, you have to figure out what are they trying to do? Where do they go with the ball? When do they get the ball out? And then you have all these numbers that says he completed 59% compared to 72%. Mm-hmm. But the guy who completed 59% might actually be more accurate. And so you have to put in the time watching the tape, because you're going to pick up on, you know, the seven drops per game or mm-hmm. receivers not being in the right spot. So, I mean, I've messed up so many times on quarterbacks, and there's no one in the league who will say that they didn't.
Of course.
But you try to figure out some of the things that will limit the failure more than even finding the success, if that makes sense. Like I've come to know some things that help me eliminate some players, eliminate some quarterbacks, or at least say, you know what, I can't go all in. But then again, like, it's changing. The whole game is changing now. So what didn't work 7 years ago is now some of those players are starting to work. The mobility, the ability to, you know, play outside of the pocket it's become much more important. Whereas, like, with Drew Brees, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, all the best quarterbacks we've seen in the past 15 years mm-hmm. were all great in the pocket. That's where they live. And you still have to be good there. But we're starting to see quarterbacks now have to have more success outside the pocket, be able to extend and have that mobility.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You actually answered like two of my follow-up questions in giving your answer to that first question. So that was perfect. in terms of, you know, not really just about evaluating a player incorrectly, because, you know, everyone does it. I mean, Ozzie Newsome traded up for Kyle Bowler. You know, I mean, Bill Belichick drafted quarterbacks that have not panned out. I mean, not really about one specific guy, but more so just about the sort of the broader process. Is there something you wish you could go back, you know, 10 years or 15 years and tell the, you know, the evaluator you were a decade ago or 15 years ago to watch out for, or, you know, that you maybe placed more emphasis on then than maybe you would now, or something that stands out in that perspective?
There are two things that, I mean, this is just off the top of my head. Two things, though, that I would say to a younger me. One, don't be so definitive when you're young and you don't know who you're trusting in terms of information. Mm-hmm. I guess a better way to put it is you got to develop relationships and you've got to get to know people who are spending, who have a staff spending all of this time going into town, you know, whether it's sitting at bars, talking to the lunch lady or lunch man, the training staff. You got to get to know the people who are spending. I mean, there's a reason that there are, I don't know, 8 to 12 scouts on each NFL staff. And there's a reason these guys are out of their home for 3+ months, you know, spending time in towns that you really couldn't even name and just really diving in. So they're going to have better information. Mm-hmm. The biggest mistake I ever made was on Jamarcus Russell. And it was early in my scouting career, if you will. And I just didn't, anyone could figure out that he had a big arm. He had a great season. He had the physical tools. I mean, he could have been great had he had the mental makeup, but he didn't. And what I questioned, and when I talked to some people that I shouldn't have trusted, it was, he's more poised. He's just, you know, nothing bothers him. He's just relaxed. What if I really knew the people that I know now and had the information, I never would have bought in to Jamarcus. And so that was a good learning lesson for me, if you will. And then the second thing is keep learning, you know, keep learning. Because with Blake Bortles, I've learned things from that. There have been numerous quarterbacks, and I go – the quarterbacks that I fail on are the ones that I go back and study why, and then try to ask more questions. I think that's the biggest thing. If you're trying to evaluate quarterbacks, you can never learn enough, but keep evolving and keep learning. And when you do make a mistake, go back and figure out why. I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned over 20 years of doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, John Gruden, Terry Bradshaw. I mean, plenty of guys who have plenty of quarterback experience were also people who were hyping Jamarcus Russell at the time. So, I mean, it wasn't like it was, you know, strictly you. It was a lot of people.
A lot of people did. But I wanted to figure out why. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the biggest reason. I didn't know his makeup.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. In terms of when you do look back and you say, okay, well, I missed on this guy, or this guy didn't live up to expectations, or even over the course of a year where you have someone like maybe a Jordan Love, where maybe, and maybe this is not how you feel, I don't want to misrepresent your opinion here, but maybe his 2019 tape wasn't as impressive in some ways as his 2018 tape. I mean, how often do you go back and say, well, the guy was good, it just was a matter of where he fit or the players around him, and then not only on a college level with someone like a Jordan Love, but then also on the NFL level where you think, okay, maybe if this guy had gone to work under Andy Reid or Sean Payton or someone who really works well with quarterbacks, he would still be a hit. It just happened to be ended up with, you know, a coach who didn't maximize his strengths or build his offense around him appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, Pat Mahomes is a great example. And you mentioned Andy Reid, so that's what jumped out to me. Pat Mahomes, if you ask any evaluator in the league, just about any, I'm sure some people will say that they had it pegged for forever. And to his credit, Brett Veach, the GM of the Chiefs, and I've talked to him and I've talked to Andy, and he was on him early and really liked him. And I remember watching Mahomes tape and saying, man, his footwork's terrible. it's kind of like sandlot football. He's drifting in the pocket. He's not like mechanically, he made you want to throw up. And seriously, like he'll admit it. I've talked to him. He said after three weeks or three months, whatever it was, after a period of time, his rookie year, he still was trying to figure out who the mic was. He's like, I was about 70%, Todd, on who the mic was, which is like the most basic thing, the middle linebacker, identifying him pre-snap, right? But my point is, it took a while because what you're used to seeing in terms of, again, like the Bradys, the Mannings, the Breezes, and the footwork and inside the pocket and protecting the ball and all the everything that you watch in the league that has been successful for so long, at that point, he didn't do any of it. He really didn't. But then the end of the play would happen, and you say, oh, boy. Like, how did that ball get there? You know, like, I saw him who was it against? I forget the game now. I want to say West Virginia, but I may be wrong. I saw him drop back, drift for no reason. He had an open pocket. 5-6 seconds later, throw off his back foot, sidearm, like picture a sidearm picture, you know, like almost like underhanded, like right, like that scooping motion. And I remember, I'll never forget watching that throw and being like, this is why I don't like this guy. And then the ball lands 60, 65 yards downfield, boom, perfectly. Like right at the goal line in his receiver's hands, and it was a perfect throw. And so you start watching those things over and over and say, all right, sometimes you got to look away from the mechanics and the mental part, and you got to study what the result is too. And that's what makes it so difficult, is that they're all different. You want the guy who has perfect footwork and protects the ball and climbs the pocket when there's outside pressure and slides laterally when there's inside pressure and keeps his eyes downfield and does all of those things. But sometimes you got to focus more on the result. And I've learned from a couple of mistakes, and I wouldn't say Mahomes was a mistake. I had him, I think, as one of the top 15 players. But I didn't know he was going to be the best player maybe in 5 years to come out of the draft.
I mean, you probably have about 30 teams with you on that side of the equation in terms of not expecting him to be one of the best players.
Yeah, but I want to be one of the two, not one of the 30.
Of course, but you know, it's the question is always right. Like you know, if Patrick Mahomes went to the Jags, not to pick on the Jags, just a team that has struggled to develop quarterbacks. First team that came to mind, you could pick a half dozen others. I mean, you know, and Patrick Mahomes.
Well, and I lost my point because I got in that whole story. But the second he was drafted by them, I turned to, I think it was Mel and Lewis. I was sitting on the, I think it was Mel and Lewis. I forget. But I turned to whoever I was with and said, this is, you know, this is perfect.
Right,
he's going to work out. I didn't know to this level, but you give a quarterback who's got all these physical tools, and it was easy to see the physical tools, a year to develop under a coach who knows how to develop quarterbacks, which, by the way, is one of the rarities, and it's sad, but it's true, and give him Alex Smith for a year so he doesn't have any pressure. He can sit there, and he can learn from a professional and a guy who's not going to be a jerk to him. He's actually going to help him develop because he's confident in his own skin, and Alex is just such a good guy, you know? And it just was the perfect situation. You give all these tools to someone who can develop him with a quarterback in front of him who will help him and allow him a year to learn how to be a pro. And the second he was drafted there, I was like, he's going to be way better than I expected him based off of just strictly my grade.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a guy who's developed not only so many quarterbacks, but also so many different kinds of quarterbacks. You know, a guy who has built offenses around Donovan McNabb and Michael Vick and Kevin Cobb and, you know, all these different guys who, you know, don't
fit
into one.
And Andy thrives on that, man.
Yeah.
Andy thrives on it. It was funny because I talked to him. I do the Chiefs preseason game, so I spent some time with him in the summer the past couple of years. And I remember talking to him, and, I mean, he can't say enough good things about Alex Smith. He loved being around him and coaching him. But I asked him, I said, are you kind of the year that that Mahomes is coming in as a first year starter? And he's like, I'm kind of invigorated. Like, I didn't have to coach the last couple of years with Alex because he knew everything.
Right.
He's like, every day is a new coaching clinic for me because, you know, Patrick's learning. He's learning the game, and it's so fun and exciting. So you could kind of see, you could see him go back almost like 15 years in his coaching career to that early excitement of teaching and coaching that Andy is, I think, if not the best in terms of quarterbacks, he's among the best in the league.
He's got to be. Yeah, absolutely. In terms of Joe Burrow,
briefly,
if I had told you this time last year, Joe Burrow was going to be the first overall pick, most likely first overall pick in the 2020 draft, how surprised would you have been?
Really surprised. I mean, I had a day three grade on him coming into the year, and you know, I do three or four tapes in the summer to just try to get a baseline on players.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a quarterback in a system where they wanted to run the ball. They weren't very dynamic. They weren't creative. And he had just gotten to Baton Rouge and
right.
still developing his leadership style, all that stuff, you know. And I sat down with him and talked to him, and I remember walking out of a meeting with him and Brian Greasy and I, I would say 9 out of 10 times at least when we walk out of a meeting with a quarterback, we have a similar feel. And I remember walking out and they're like, "What'd you think, man?" He's like, "I don't know." I was like, "I don't either," you know, because he's a different cat. But you come to realize that's part of his greatness is that he is a different cat. He doesn't care what anyone else thinks. He respected Brian, but he didn't care that Brian Greasy's Brian Greasy or anything like that, you know. So there was that part of it, and then the tape was just so average. They were not a team that was doing a lot,
right?
And then they adjusted, and Joe Brady came in as the offensive coordinator. And listen, he wasn't even calling all the plays,
right?
You know, people misconstrue that he was not calling all the plays. I think he was just calling third downs. But he brought an element of opening things up to the offense. And Joe Burrow, you got to remember, he was sitting behind all those unbelievable quarterbacks in terms of college quarterbacks at Ohio State and had all that success. And he just wanted to go find a place to play. And so he got a place to play. And then his second year, he finds a coordinator that lets him rip. And that was the biggest difference. He just needed it. First of all, he needed that first year to develop as a leader, get his feet underneath him, and realize that, hey, I can do this at a very high level. And then he found a coordinator who brought the best out of him. And he also had a running back that had the best year of his career. He had an offensive line that developed. He had wide receivers that were young and finally broke out and started to go make plays. And so it was a perfect storm. It all came together. To answer your question there, if there's any concern, yeah. Why is it that it was only 1 year? Why didn't he win the job at Ohio State? Why didn't he have a little bit more success or put up bigger numbers his first year at LSU? So you go through all that, but then you just got to go back to the tape. And there are very few quarterbacks, again, in 20 years of doing this, that I can watch from beginning to end in a season and see the kind of consistency and high-level play that I saw from Joe this past year. Just like the knowing when to move inside the pocket, feeling it, being courageous, having the onions, if you will, to hang in there and make a throw, and then getting knocked out by an SEC defender and popping right back up and then stepping up in the pocket the next play and throwing the ball down the field and taking another hit. Like, those are the things you see over and over again that make me believe at least that he's going to be a really, really special player. I mean, it's close. Tua's got a different Tua Tagovailoa, the Alabama quarterback, has a little bit of a different skill set. And it would be fascinating in terms of the debates within war rooms, if you will, the draft rooms, if Tua didn't have the durability questions,
right,
because I think they're that close. But because Joe's been healthy and doesn't have some of the issues that Tua has in terms of concerns with the durability, I think it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah. All right, one more question for you, Todd, and then we'll wrap up. In your most recent mock draft, you have Jordan Love going to the Chargers at 6 ahead of Justin Herbert. Is that something that's Chargers specific for you? Would you evaluate Love as better than Herbert in a vacuum? What stands out to you as sort of the difference between Jordan Love and Justin Herbert?
Herbert has a ton of talent. He really does. And, you know, yes, he's introverted. That is that definitely factors into the equation. He's improved as a leader. He knows it. He's talked about it. When we met with him in September, October, he was reading a book on how to be an extroverted leader or something along those lines. He's saying all the right things now, as he should, and I get it. And I like him. He's really smart. He's got probably the strongest arm. He and Jacob Eason, I would say, are right there in terms of the strongest arms in the class. He makes some throws that very few other guys can make. When he takes off running and gets going, he really is mobile. But what I see that concerns me with Justin Herbert is he hangs on to his first read a little bit too long. Mm-hmm. And while, again, he can take off and run, but he's not very good at buying time. The short area quickness, agility, suddenness, however, twitch, whatever you want to call it. And if the biggest concern with a young quarterback is you got to be one or the other to get past the first couple of years and to have some success. You got to be able to either extend, or you got to be smart enough to have enough of the answers to get the ball out. And I shouldn't say smart. You have to process quickly enough, because Justin is extremely smart. He really is. It's just, does he process quickly enough with reading coverages? So that's what concerns me, is that I think he's going to have a tough couple of years. And with Jordan, he's going to have a tough couple of years. But he's more mobile, he can extend, and what he does best is he creates on the fly. And I think that's going to be his best trait in the league. I'd love to see any quarterback in a Mahomes-type situation. I'm not saying he's Mahomes by any stretch of the imagination, but he has some of that magic in terms of throwing off balance. When chaos ensues, mm-hmm, I think that's when Mahomes is at his best, and he's getting better on schedule, meaning inside the pocket, 3-5-7 step drop, timing, all those things as his NFL career goes on. And I think Love will continue to do the same things, but the similarity between the two is you can create a mess and they kind of love it and they thrive on that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he had 17 interceptions, but I can write off 7 or 8 of them if I want to make excuses for him this past year. I also can tell you that he had nine starters from his offense that left from the previous year where he had slightly better numbers. But I also, thanks to our stats and information group, can tell you that the numbers aren't that different outside of the 17 interceptions from 18 to 19, which tells you with a new coaching staff and 9 other new starters playing, you know, with a level of competition that's not awesome, he got better, even though the numbers don't line up with that.
That's awesome. Well, Todd, I mean, people can check you out on ESPN.com. You're on TV all the time, the First Draft podcast. You're all over ESPN, but it's a pleasure to have you come on the show today.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it, man. Keep up the good work.
All right, thanks so much, Todd. And now, joining me to talk about the quarterbacks from an analytical side, and particularly, specifically, to talk about the presumed first overall pick in Joe Burrow, it is our analytics writer at ESPN who covers college football, my good friend, Bill Connolly. Bill, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Let me ask you this question. We asked Todd McShay this question in the first segment. I want to ask you the same question here in the second segment. If I had told you this time last year that Joe Burrow would be pretty much the consensus pick to be the first overall selection in the 2020 NFL draft, how surprised would you have been?
Pretty surprised. The potential was obvious. Let's say that right out front. Cause I remember, when I was writing, previews about LSU in the off season, the whole concept was he looked great the last four games of 2018, was really throwing vertical. It looked good on him. The receivers were awesome, of course. And that, if this Joe Brady guy brings anything to the table and another year of experience, maybe they could do some good things. You combine that with the fact that he's a big, tall, white guy with a big arm, then sure, maybe I could have talked myself into him being the number one pick. But then he comes out, plays like five of the top 10 teams in the country, posts the first 200 passer rating per the college formula, at least. Mm-hmm. First ever, pretty much. And it was the best passing year a quarterback has ever had, and that part would have surprised me.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the strange thing in a way. It's almost as if the numbers are so good with, a 76.3% completion percentage, 56, 71 yards, 60 touchdowns, 6 picks. No concerns about, quality of defense that he faced. I mean, is there anything in this statistical profile that concerns you or makes you think that there's just – that something's impossible for him to keep up?
Yeah, I just looked it up. So their opponents last year included, per my SP Plus rankings, the numbers 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 9 teams in the country, plus 21 and 26. And they were first in passing success rate, first in passer rating, 76%. It was absurd, top to bottom. But I guess the concern I would have, and this is, you really kind of have to spin this a little bit because, he was pretty much perfect all season. But, if you're a believer that the source of your biggest strength is probably the source of your biggest weakness too, he was amazingly patient last year. And you could easily, if you wanted to spin that into him being a little too patient, he did have about a 6% sack rate, which isn't terrible, but it's not great. You could paint a picture of him taking a crazy number of sacks next year. If his receivers aren't as open, if he's letting things happen and he's a little too calm, maybe that blows up and he gets hit a lot and maybe he gets David Carr-itis or whatever and that impacts him. But that's the spin you have to put on it to find anything negative. It was a ridiculous. 6% sack rate for how vertical he was throwing part of the time is really not bad. It's just a question of if those can he settle a little faster? Can he check down a little faster than he had to last year? His poise was ridiculous, and it is a clear strength, but it can backfire on him a little bit.
Mm-hmm. In those bigger games last year, because I won't pretend that I was breaking down Joe Burrow tape. It certainly seemed like there were a lot of plays where he was sort of identifying the best one-on-one matchup and tossing up a 50-50 ball for the receiver to catch. And that's, good that you're trusting your receivers, you're putting the ball in catchable spots, making good throws, but I think it's fair to say he had great receivers at LSU. So, how do you sort of account for that or discount that when you're looking at how he played?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say it was 50-50 balls, but I would say that his receivers were absurd. And obviously maybe there's AJ Green running around there. Maybe that becomes an above average receiving core overall. But yeah, Justin Jefferson was extremely boom or bust until this last year. Then he was just boom, nonstop boom. Jamar Chase was the best receiver in the country. His hands are as good, just the hand catching ability is about as good as you're ever going to see in college. Terrace Marshall would have been the number one on most receiving cores, and he was the number three. Clyde Edwards-Helaire, just on down the list, Thaddeus Moss and Edwards-Helaire out of the backfield. The wonderfully named Racy McMath would have been a star in a lot of teams. He had 17 catches because there wasn't enough to go around. He had that advantage. I wouldn't say he was spitting balls into tight windows. He was he was trusting his receivers for sure, but I don't think he's going to have the problem of just lobbing it up there and hoping that his guy comes down with it necessarily. Mm-hmm. He is going to be used to his guys being open, though.
Yes. Maybe they will get open. Who knows? I mean, you know, that Bengals scheme was impossible to grade last year because every one of their offensive linemen got hurt or played terribly. So you would figure that would be hopefully better for him in 2020. In terms of the year-to-year leap, I mean, obviously you said, you know, the first guy with a college passer rating over 200. I'm guessing there has been nobody that has made quite this sort of leap from year to year, but what do you think about guys, you know, not just your one-season examples, not like, you know, a Cam Newton or even a Mitchell Trubisky, but guys who have been at the same school from year to year and made a significant leap, and that's led to them being, you know, highly touted for the NFL draft. Have those guys typically turned out well? Is there anybody in sort of Burrow's neighborhood when it comes to that sort of improvement from year to year?
Yeah, I mean, the best example I have is the one that you've heard before probably, and that's Carson Palmer. You know, he was an all-world recruit coming out of high school. He played his freshman year. He played more than Joe Burrow did, but he was regarded generally as disappointing for most of his career. He had a 123 passer rating his first year, 118 his sophomore year, 124 his junior year. It just, USC was mediocre. He was mediocre. But everything clicks with Pete Carroll and his staff, I guess, the second year in charge there in 2002, completes 63% of his passes, which would be like, you know, in the year 2002, which was somehow almost 20 years ago, by the way. I saw a tidbit the other day how, like, the gap between Dazed and Confused, like, when in 1976 and when they filmed Dazed and Confused would have been like filming a movie now about the year 2003. I kind of passed out when I saw that, but
I hate
either
it.
Way, anyway, 2002, 63% pass completion rate in 2002 would have been what, about 68 or 70% probably in 2020. He had 33 touchdowns to 10 interceptions, almost 4,000 yards, while not moving at a high tempo at all, for USC. So, that's as, I think, as close as you can come. I've tried to find better examples. I don't think there is one. And I mean, Palmer, you know, goes number one, I think, right? And does, I mean, he has injuries, but he was clearly a good quarterback for much of his career.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's not, would that be a successful career if Joe Burrow had Carson Palmer's career? I think so, but it wouldn't be fun. Like, I think Carson Palmer is someone who, you know, could have been a Hall of Famer with, you know, if he doesn't have those serious knee injuries early in his career.
Right.
Which, you know, through his mechanics and sort of he wandered through the wilderness with the Bengals team that wasn't really committed to winning for a while. That's a whole other conversation. But it's, you know, that's not a bust. I mean, you wouldn't say maybe it's the Hall of Famer you're hoping for, but it's certainly not, you know, a failure.
Right. No, I mean, if he produces that kind of career, whatever the equivalent of that is now, I think it was basically there's no way you can call it a bust or a big disappointment or anything. But when you just produce the best passing season of all time in college football, it does feel like the bar is higher. Like you want to see more than that, even if you can't necessarily be disappointed if he's quote unquote only Carson.
So would you say, I mean, you just said it, so I guess just let me confirm it here. Would you say this was, after adjusting for era, the best season we've seen from a quarterback in college football history?
I just don't know how it couldn't be at this point. Like, you know, LSU fans at the end of the year were, you know, we were the best team of all time. And I'm not going to go that far because their defense was banged up and pretty mediocre for much of the season. And I mean, their run game was good enough, but it wasn't amazing or anything. But the passing specifically, the numbers just make you laugh out loud. When you get used to what a normal college, what a normal good college quarterback can do, and then you see, with help from the fact that he played 15 games, obviously, which makes things a little more obnoxious, but 5,600 yards, 60 TDs, 76% completion, 14 yards per completion. It's crazy. It's when you combine that with the fact that he played half the top 10, I don't know how it couldn't be the best season.
Is there anyone else who comes to mind for you as, like, comparable?
Well, I mean, this is an era of great passing, clearly. You know, what Tua Tagovailoa did until the very, very end of last year. I mean, he was on pace to be the first 200 passer rating guy until the last game. Like, if he throws, like, one fewer pick or one fewer incompletion against Clemson, then he passes 200. And it's with what he was doing even this year. He looked better in some ways this year. He was
right there. But he couldn't quite, he couldn't cap it the way Joe Burrow capped it by destroying Clemson this year. So that was up there. Baker Mayfield's last season is up there. You adjust for era, then you can certainly get into like the Ty Detmers of the world and whatnot. But just in an era of obnoxious passing numbers, he topped them all while probably playing harder schedules too.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Tua Tagovailoa. In terms of the other prospects in this class, I'm not going to ask you or expect you to pick one of them over Joe Burrow. But in terms of their sort of individual skill sets or aspects of each of their play that end up as meaningful, is there some meaningful element of what these other quarterbacks do that would maybe lead a team or lead someone who's making decisions to prefer them to Joe Burrow?
I would assume he's going to top every list, but you could, you know, if you're not worried about injury, if Tua's hip is going to be fine, which is obviously quite the if. It's a very unique injury, and we can have faith that he's going to be all right, but until we see it, it's hard to completely believe it. But his accuracy, his ability to read and make quick decisions and fire off extremely accurate passes to guys, you know, throw them open, hit them on the run, it was astoundingly good. And my concern with Tua, if there is one, aside from, you know, he's leaving college with the quote-unquote injury-prone label because of a bunch of freak injuries where, like, you know, Adrian Peterson got hurt a lot at OU too, and he was quote-unquote injury-prone, and then he's running 35 years later. He's still running for 1,000 yards or whatever. But, if he isn't really injury-prone, if he's able to have a good career, healthy career, he could be very, very good. My concern is that you could watch him and think maybe it's more of a kind of an automaton kind of thing, right? Where, you know, he's taking what the defense gives. He's making really natural reads. He's not necessarily making plays on his own. He's just throwing accurate passes and get into, you know, into large windows where guys are wide open. You could probably make that case if you're a little concerned about that, but he was about as good as we've seen until Joe Burrow came along. And I think there's still a lot to be said. This is a pretty bad draft class after that. Justin Herbert is clearly naturally talented, but he was inconsistent. Like, I maybe that had to do with injuries and maybe it didn't, but I don't completely love Justin Herbert. Mm-hmm. I loved Jordan Love in 2018, and then the job got a little harder this last year with the new receiving corps, and suddenly he was getting baited into lots of bad passes, and that concerned me. But those top two, I think, if two is healthy, I think those top two are both going to be really good.
Do you think obviously the hip injury does matter, but let's say there was no hip injury. Do you think we would be underestimating Tua as a prospect because Joe Burrow is so, you know, extraordinary and his season was such a huge outlier?
Yeah, I mean, Tua's a little, you know, I would assume that undersized doesn't mean nearly what it used to mean, but he's, you know, only 6'1 and 220 or whatever, not, you know, the glorious 6'5 or whatever that Burrow is. And, you know, maybe that would lead to him being undervalued. Maybe the fact that Burrow beat him this year, even though he was hurt. I mean, if he's not limping along in that game, even before the hip injury, maybe Alabama comes back and wins that game too. Maybe he doesn't just fumble unforced at the 2-yard line of LSU and that flips the game around. But if Burrow beats him, maybe that becomes one of those, like, he won the duel, therefore he's better kind of things, and we undervalue Tua a little bit. But Tua's accuracy is pretty crazy, and I think he's still a heck of a overall prospect, even if we do kind of assume that Burrow's better now.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. When do we want to set a time in the future? 5 years? 10 years? 5 years from now. 5 years from now, it's 2024. 2024, after the 2024 NFL season.
Okay.
What do you think the chances are that we look back and we say the Bengals should have drafted Tua Tagovailoa over Joe Burrow with the first overall pick?
Obviously not great. Like, I think we know who the best odds are right now. But again, if that patience backfires, his timing gets off, he gets hit by NFL defensive ends a little bit and starts rushing throws or making worse reads, then, I mean, we've seen this snowball on guys before. It's just, it kind of snowballed him on him in some ways in 2018. And just the fact that we saw him struggle and the fact that we saw him learn from those struggles and become what he became, I think it makes it even, you know, it's like the you know, a boxer who lost a couple fights and learned from him instead of a guy who hasn't really been, who hasn't ever really been punched before. So, I think he's about as surefire as you're going to get, especially when you factor in the fact that he's pretty mobile. He can escape pressure and he can run when he needs to. He can take a hit. You know, Auburn, that was their whole plan, was tackle the receivers, make them earn it, and hit Burrow as much as possible, and he still beat them in the fourth quarter. So he's proven a lot, and I would assume we're not going to think back on you know, they should have drafted Tua, they should have drafted Jordan Love or whatever. I would assume he's kind of the number one for a reason here.
I'm going to need a percentage, Bill. What do you think? Do you think, I mean, obviously.
So the percentage that we're going to regret, that the Bengals are going to regret it and think they should have picked somebody else, we'll say.
They should have picked Tua.
Okay. 12%.
12? Okay. That's pretty big. I mean, I would have guessed, if you had asked me to guess the number, I would have said maybe 20.
Okay.
So 12 is telling. I think that's pretty dramatic.
Two is still pretty good. And again, he could get hit a lot. So we'll see. But I'd still, you know, that's still, you flip that around, that's still an 88% chance that Burrow's better. And that's not something I would have expected to say 6 months ago.
Yes, that's very dramatic.
8 months ago now. 8 months ago now.
Was there, I'll finish up with this, was there, whether it was a game last year, you mentioned those final four games of 2018, or a game this year where the switch kind of flipped and you were like, oh, this is for real. Was it the Bama game? What was that moment for you with Joe Burrow?
I think there were a couple. The first one was against Texas in the second game. Now, clearly Texas wasn't an amazing team, but I mean, this is LSU. If you're a college football fan, LSU is the team that is still finding the Leonard Fournettes, the big burly guys, and just trying to physically dominate you. And they had the lead late in the game at Texas, and Texas' offense was very good. Burrow takes a sack or you know, almost throws a pick, and he seems a little flustered, and they still say basically, you know, go win the game. It's like third and 17 or something like that. They don't run the ball and punt with 2 minutes left. He steps into the pocket. He fires the ball to whichever open receiver. I don't even remember. Jefferson, I think. Jefferson goes for a touchdown, wins the game. Just LSU, the stalwart conservative team, basically won the game with offense because they trusted Burrow that much. And that was huge. And then Auburn was the closest thing he got to a real, real, real defensive test in his career. I mean, Auburn had a tremendous defense last year. And again, they hit him a lot. They held LSU to 23 points. But it's still, when he needed to generate scoring drives, he did. That was the kind of everything's going wrong and we need you to win it anyway game, and he did it. So those two were, I think, at that point, you know, after Auburn, they go to Alabama and that becomes a track meet and all that. Like we kind of knew at that point what he had to offer. But I think the Auburn game was the biggest turning point just because he was challenged and had to work for it a little more.
Awesome. Well, Bill, we will not bring this back up if Joe Burrow has an anonymous NFL career. We will leave it in the
archive. I really appreciate it. Let it die, yeah.
But I have faith that you are correct. I happen to believe in your opinion about Joe Burrow and about all things college football. So if people want to check out more of your college football coverage, where can they do that?
Well, there's this website called ESPN.com. And really, we're talking about football. We really mean soccer.
Yes, that's true. That's, we're both soccer writers now.
That's right. Football was just the Trojan horse. But Twitter at ESPN_BillC and probably somewhere on the ESPN college football page at any time.
Awesome. Well, Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much to my guests today, Todd McShay and Bill Connolly, both of ESPN. More NFL stuff coming up in the weeks to come. Looks like the draft is going to be on time, so we will have draft content coming later this month. But obviously a lot to talk about still in the NFL, still plenty of free agents unsigned, draft stuff on the way. We're going to make fun of Dave Gettleman for not knowing how to use computers when we get to the draft. But until then, thanks so much for listening.